Thank you very much for the invitation. I think this slide is not necessary anymore after the first lecture. It was just showing what satisfiability is. Since we are going to talk about satisfiability many times in the talk, what is a model. Okay, but this talk I'm going to focus on quantifiers. I have a very simple problem here, right? We have universal quantifiers, right? We have we use this symbol for all x. I'm not putting the softs here. I mean, in this example, assume that x and y are real variables, right? Just to be compact, I'm not saying if x is real or not, but in this example, assume a real variable. We have universal quantifiers in this example. We have also the spatial quantifiers, like this y, right? And basically, in this problem, what we are saying, for all x, exists a y such that if x is greater than 0, then f of x, y is equal to 0, right? For all x, there is a y such that holds if x is greater than 0. This is actually, this formula is satisfiable. We have a model that's very simple. Just select f to be the constant function, a function that's 0 everywhere, right? If it's a function that is 0 everywhere, for sure you can find, for all x, you can find a y, right? The x doesn't even need to be greater than 0, right? For this example, for this interpretation here, for example, right, it satisfies the quantifier. It satisfies even something stronger, right? It satisfies for all x, exists y, f of x, y equals 0, right? There are other models, right? You can say that this is also a model for this problem. F is a polynomial y squared minus x. Right? You can see that if x is greater than 0, this polynomial here always has a root, right? Always has a 0, right? This, if x is negative, this is not true, right? In this way, this here is a model that you really need the assumption that x greater than 0, right? Here, my main point for this example is to show that quantifiers are going to be hard, right? You see from this example that you can do something that is really sophisticated, you can do synthesis. Right? You can state properties about a function f, and your model is going to contain interpretation for f that satisfies all these properties. Right? You can feel like SMT-SUB in this case working like as synthesizing a function f that has the properties you want. Right? But why? I mean, how quantifiers are used in SMT? Right? I think the main application for quantifiers is kernel verification. Right? Verification tools, I think, are the main consumers of this kind of problem. And why they need that, right? The first thing you're going to see is that for modeling the runtime, right? Usually these tools are going to have a big set of formulas that states properties of the runtime. I mean, what I mean by runtime is that suppose that you have a Java language, right? Java, the memory has a vanity heap has to satisfy some properties, right? Here I have one example from a language that's not really Java, it's Spec Sharp. Spec Sharp is based on C Sharp, that's, if you're not Microsoft, C Sharp is like Java, right? Okay, Spec Sharp is something. It's a bunch, you can view as a bunch of Java where you have annotations that states properties of your kernel. And here is a quantifier that states a property of what is a valid heap in a spec sharp program. We also have most of these verification tools, they work in a modular way. Basically, you're going to start decorating your kernel with properties. Basically, when you have a function f, right, you're going to state, you're going to provide a contract. You're going to say this function can be used in this environment where the arguments x is greater than 0, y is less than x. You say properties about the input arguments of this function. Then you also have a contract saying what this function guarantees. Right? In this kind of modular verification, when you're proving a function that f satisfies its contract, you assume that the contracts of the other functions used by f, you assume these other contracts are satisfied. But when you have this kind of modular verification, you have to add what it's called frame axioms, right? The frame axiom, for instance, when you call a function g, for instance, this function can change usually functions in Java or C, they have side effects. They change locations of the heap, of the memory, right? The frame axiom basically states what didn't change, right? Basically, I would have 0.5 saying, oh, look, these parts of your memory were not modified. Usually, avoid any one of these modification tools. I can give some VCC, ESC Java, Y from France, right? There are many very fine compilers, right? You want to find frame axioms in all of them. Sometimes you also want to prove properties. The property you want to state about your program, you need to use quantifiers. Like, for instance, suppose that you're talking about arrays. You want to say that your array is sorted. You have a function for sorting, quick sort. Probably your post condition, you're going to have something like that, right? A quantifier stating that the array is indeed sorted, right? And finally, another use is extra theories, right? SMT solvers support some theories, like arithmetic, bit vectors. I mean, Chazadeh describes some of them, right? And this is essentially general purpose theories, right? Everybody agrees what arithmetic is, right? Everybody agrees what's bit vectors, what the properties of the bit vector theory. But in some verification compilers, sometimes you need some theory, right, that's not exact. Here I have one that's actually used in the spec chart, VCC. It's like a partial order. You say, well, why do you need a partial order? Right? In the actual, what they have a partial order, a piece of subtype. They're saying that X is a class, and basically saying that X is a subclass of X. We're saying that X is a subclass of Y, and Y is a subclass of Z. X is a subclass of Z, right? We have a partial order that's basically your type system in your programming language. But the problem is that it's not just a partial order. There are many more axioms, right? And so even if you implement a tier of partial orders, that's not exactly what they want. They want some kind of extra properties. In this way, having quantifiers for encoding these theories, the special purpose theories is an extra plus, right? The main challenge is, I'm going to say this later, I'm going to keep emphasizing that the problem is undecidable when you put quantifiers, right? And then one of the main challenges is that all of these efficient tools, they call verifiers, but everybody that uses them, they are actually trying to find bugs, right? They're trying to find problems in the program. They're not trying to prove. The proof is like a byproduct. So like when you say, I managed to prove, you didn't manage to prove anything, you're just saying, you cannot find more bugs. I think that's the right way to say it, right? You have a model, and when your tool says prove as probably maybe there are bugs there, you prove some abstraction of your software, right? All these verified compilers have many assumptions about the memory, about the runtime, and they don't, sometimes they don't reflect the reality, right? They are simplifying abstraction, you do some simplification. In this way, what you really care is about finding bugs, right? And bugs usually, what is a bug? A bug is usually when you have a satisfiable formula, right? And this way, you want to be really fast in satisfiable instances, right? And here I'm going to show the general structure of these verifying compilers. Basically, you get an annotated program, right? And you convert it into a verification condition, a formula. You can ask what do you mean by annotated program. This is a program that have pre-imposed conditions, invariants, additional annotations, right? Basically, a verifying compiler is just a consistency checker, right? It's checking if your annotations are compatible with your program, right? They're not proving anything. They're just proving that the annotations are consistent with your program, right? But correctness, I mean, your annotations can be wrong, right? I saw that many times. It's not the program that is wrong, the annotation is wrong, right? And sometimes everything is wrong. The program is wrong, the annotation is wrong, everything is wrong. But one big thing that you will see sometimes is that this structure. You have a bunch of axioms using quantifiers, stating properties of the runtime, and you have sometimes, that's not always true, you have a big NDOR tree that doesn't have quantifiers, right? This NDOR tree is essentially encoding the control flow and data flow of your program, right? You have the NDOR tree encoding all paths in a particular procedure, right? And here's one example of the JPyC compiler. Right, we start here with the C code. You have to see there are some annotations and variants here. It generates, the VCC compiler is going to create intermediate form in the, something called BootETL, this is a variable level language. And here you have the text that was automatically generated from your code, annotated code, and one part that's called the prelude, that is the set of axioms that are modeling the runtime. But every VCC program must satisfy the prelude. And you have a bunch of axioms there, and you get these two sets of axioms, convert to SMT, and you can send to a SMT solver, and basically you can have verified the property, the annotations were verified, they hold, they don't hold, and something that happens all the time is a timeout, you cannot verify it. You can find much more about VCC in this website. It's open source, the source code is all there, right? You have a C, it's really, if you are interested in software verification, I highly recommend VCC because you have all this. I'm just building this front end for parsing C code, the annotations and everything. This is already a lot of work. But there are a lot of bad news, right? So if you're trying to solve SMT when you have quantifiers. The first thing, suppose that you don't forget theories, right? You have just first order logic, pure first order logic. It's already semi-decidable, right? Pure first order logic, called by pure first order logic, is this new F that Chetri talks about, but you put quantifiers on top of that, right? What do I mean by semi-decidable? It means that it's possible to build a prover here, a tool, that if the problem is unsatisfiable, if your formula is unsatisfiable, eventually it will be able to find it. If it is satisfiable, it may run forever, right? That's the first bad news. Now, suppose that you just put linear integer arithmetic on top of that. Now you have quantifiers, UF, and linear integer arithmetic. Now the problem is undecidable, right? You can run forever. If it's unset, if it is set, right? There's no way you can build a solver that's always going to terminate for this kind of problem. Just putting linear integer arithmetic. But nonetheless, this kind of I think this is a bunch of sad news, bad news, of course. But nonetheless, this kind of tool has been applied for verifying new pieces of software, like the hypervisor. The hypervisor is a virtualization layer between the hardware and the operating system. You see, like in Microsoft, when you say you want to run different operating systems, different versions of Windows, right? That's what they mean by multi-symbol systems. And what you want to prove, right? I mean, what they want to prove is like the operating system with rare exceptions. I mean, the hypervisor has some APIs that allow you to detect that you're running inside of the hypervisor. More of these APIs, the operating system will not know if it is running inside of the hypervisor or in the actual hardware, right? That was the one big property. There's many challenges. I mean, each VC here, each formula that's created that we call verification conditions, the formula that's outputted by VCC is several megabytes, right? There are thousands of universal quantifiers, and the developers are willing to wait only 5 minutes, right, for each. I mean, keep in mind, people have this idea that verifying compilers is something that you let it running overnight, and the morning you arrive, says prove it, right? This is completely far from the truth, right? I mean, writing these annotations is like writing code, right? It's a bunch of people that do this verification effort. They work like a team. Like when you develop software, I think anybody that's worked in a team developing software, someone you make a modification, you are done, but someone else is affected by your modification, right? And vice versa, you ask them to fix something, he fixes something and breaks something else off. Another guy in the group, right? The same thing with specifications, right? It's an interactive process, right? And this is a picture from a friend of mine. He sent this picture complaining about CZ3. And the story is like, Michal Moskal is the guy that's one of the main designers of the VCC system. and it's an expert verification and something this teacher saying, look, after 60 seconds, we start losing focus, right? And after 1 hour, you lose interest, right? So you don't care about these fine compilers anymore, right? Imagine if your compiler, he gave a good analogy. Suppose that every time you try to compile your program takes 1 hour, right? You are not going to write big programs, right? Okay, this is the motivation why we need compilers, right? Now I want to start talking about some techniques on how to handle compilers. The first one is negation normal form. Maybe yesterday this stuff was covered, but negation normal form is a I just do a quick review it. The idea is that you put in a form, right, where the negation is only on the leads, right? You can have arbitrary and ors, right? But the lead, you can only have negation on the leads. And the whole point of this negation normal form, you move the negation inside, right? For instance, you have a not of or, is it basically if you move inside, you transform it for ends of the knots, right? You keep moving the negation inside. That's the idea of converting to negation normal form, right? This is really nice, this conversion, right? The nice thing is that converting to CNF, if you want to produce an equivalent formula, you can have exponential blow up, but negation normal form, there's no exponential blow up. This is much nicer. Here's a small problem, a small example. When you put this form in negation normal form, right? Notice that the universal became existential when you move this negation inside, right? Another thing that we do a lot in theorem proving is called scholemization. You can get rid of the main idea is that you can get rid of the existential quantifiers, right? If you have xy, f of xy, where x is a, there is a for all x here. Keep that in mind. There's a for all x, and basically you want to eliminate the existential. You can do that by creating an equisatisfiable formula where you replace y by a new fresh function symbol, and you do this application f of x. You may say, well, why is preserve satisfiability, right? You can view f as a choice function. The cool thing about f, it tells us, for every x, what's the y you have to pick, right? That's the basic idea of scholemization. And the nice thing, if in the end, your SMT solver produces a model, right? It has a lot of information. It tells you, for every x, what's the y you have to pick, right? This way, when you do scholemization, one nice consequence is that if your SMT solver managed to produce a model, show the form is satisfiable, it tells you how to pick the value of y given for each x. Here's more example. One thing that I want to emphasize, polarization is not preserving equivalence. It's just the output, the resulting formula is equi-satisfiable, but it's not equivalent. Right? It's like it's efficient, maybe yes, it was covered, it's efficient CNF conversion, right? Where you produce a problem that's equi-satisfiable but it's not equivalent. I mean, these are you have to keep in mind this stuff that happens all the time. Some pre-processing steps preserve equivalence, others only preserve satisfiability. And scholemization is one of them. Okay, this simple example, again, eliminating the exists y, right? Replacing y by f of x. And now you should view f as the choice function. For every x, it's going to tell us what's the y, right? In this way, after you apply negation normal form, after that you apply scholemization, now you have only universal quantifiers, right? And they are the problematic ones, right? There are many techniques, as I said, the problem is undecidable, right? I mean, when you have something like that, if someone tells you I have a technique that works for every problem domain you have, they are lying to you. Doesn't it need to be undecidable? I mean, if you go NXP time complete problem, we have decision procedures for fragmented time, NXP time complete, key space complete, it's already impractical. I mean, the complexity is too high. The kinds of problems you can solve, and if you could do that, it would be amazing. You could solve so problems that are super complicated if this was possible. But that's not the case. In the SMT solvers, I'm going to use a bunch of different techniques. I will try to talk about two of them, right? But I put some notes. I will not have time to cover everything, but you can check these slides online later about other approaches. The first one I want to talk, I think, is the one that's most used in SMT solvers. I think the main motivation why it is so popular is because suppose that you implemented the SMT solver that doesn't have any support for quantifiers, right? You have your SMT solver, it works really well, and now you want to add support for quantifiers, right? This heuristic quantifier instantiation is great. The design, you don't need to change a lot of the design of your solver, right? If it's an afterthought, you can add it as a new feature without having to change everything. I think that's one of the new motivations why this is popular. And the whole idea of this heuristic quantifier instantiation is that for every universal quantifier, you're going to have a pattern or trigger, right? And the basic idea is, if you can find an instance of this pattern, you instantiate the universal quantifier. For instance, in this example here, you see there's no instance of f of g of x, right? You have f of a, you have g of b, but you don't have a f of g of something, right? But this technique is a little bit better than that, right? It does not just match pattern matching, simple pattern matching. It takes the inequalities into account, right? If you take the inequalities into account, we are going to see that we have a matching, right? You have a equals g of b, and we have f of a. Since you have a equals g of b, you can replace the a by g of b, this way you have a matching. This way, the in-matching means you are going to do the matching, but you are going to take the equalities into account. That's the whole idea. And in this example, you're going to have a matching. You're going to find that instantiates x with b. You're going to get instantiates quantifier. You're going to have f of g of b equals b. And this is going to trigger inconsistency and we're done. But in general, what's the in-matching problem, right? The in-matching problem can be formally described as given a set of equalities, right? By grounds, I mean, it should be defined as quantifier free. I have a bunch of equalities. I have a ground term T, and I have a pattern, a trigger P. And I want to find all possible instances, right? And the output is going to be this set of substitutions, right? Such that for each one of these substitutions, if you apply them to P, T and P are going to be equal modulo the equalities you have, right? Here I have this one example. You have these two equalities, right? I have this term g of a, and I have a pattern g of f of x. You see, if you use just matching, this doesn't match, right? G of f of x doesn't match g of a. But if we take the equalities into account, there are two possible matches, right? X to B and X to C, right? Everybody seen that? That's, for instance, if I replace A by G, F of B, right? I have a matching, right? G of F of B, I replace X with B, I have the matching. And the same thing with C, right? The main matching, matching is a heuristic, but it has a lot of problems. Right. The first problem is that the number of instances can be exponential, right? The other thing is that even if you have pure first order logic, right? Remember that I said in the beginning that pure first order logic is semi-decidable. I mean, we're going to say sometimes when you create a tuned program for first order logic, you say, "Oh, this tuned program is reputationally complete." What it means is, if the problem is unset, your prover is capable of showing the problem to be unset, for sure. It may take forever, like thousands of years, but it will one day show it to be unsatisfiable. Okay, these are two big problems, but at least for verification, these verification problems, right? The main challenges are you have to do the in-matching incrementally. Right. Chesney talks in the first lecture about this theory, so when you connect tiers, you want to do them online. I think the term he uses it's online tree solving, and when you keep the set solver keeps you send you partial assignments. It's the same thing when you have you want to apply game matching. You have to keep doing it while you are searching, right? And the other challenge is that for this the efficient problem, sometimes you have a huge set of patterns that you have to consider. Here I have a UX solver. I will not try to cover it. But the only thing I need for you to remember is that UX solvers are using something called the union finding structure. I will not explain it in detail, but just keep in mind that these solvers have something, some kind of mapping from terms to terms. Basically, you have something like that, that initially A maps to A, B maps to B. It's like the identity mapping, right? And as these solvers execute, they execute the following way. When suppose that you have, you want to process this equality, f of g of A equals C, right? They do something we call merging the equivalence classes, right? But for us, what's sufficient to see is that we are going to update this mapping. You are seeing that f of g of A equals C. Now, instead of f of g of A mapping to f of g of A, you map to C, right? The solvers are going to update the mapping in this way. That's the only thing we need to know for understanding and matching, that we have this mapping f, right? And here is the abstract version of the matching procedure, right? Basically, you have the following match is a procedure that's giving a pattern, a term, and a set of substitutions, right? It produces a new set of substitutions that such that this guy is equal to the term is equal to the pattern, right? For each one, if you apply substitution, that holds. Right. You're basically moving the substitution around. Basically, you start with one empty substitution, and in the end, you are going to have all substitutions that make the pattern equal to the term, right? And also, the nice thing, with an example, is going to be easier to understand. I know this is very convoluted, but the whole point here that I want to make is for the first and the last cases. And the last case also is why you can produce exponential number of instances. It explains why you can produce exponential number of instances. But the first case, it's easy. But if you're trying to match x, a variable, with a term, right? What can happen, right? Two things can happen. Actually, three, right? The first thing, x, you have a bunch of substitutions inside of x, right? You can break these substitutions into sets, right? In one set, x is already bound to something. X is already being mapped to something, right? And I want to keep only, if x is mapped to something, I want to keep only substitutions that whatever x is being mapped to, right, it is equal to what t is equal to t. Right, that's why I'm doing this f star. F, if you remember, is the mapping. Remember, if you go back, f tells us that f of g of a equals c, f of g of b equals f of g of b, right? So you have this mapping. If you keep applying f, right?
What's the
problem? Oh, this is the example that I was going through in this slide. That's a difficult, I skipped. But,
so this is what the U is given?
Yeah, in the top is the problem that you are trying to decide if it's satisfiable or not.
Yeah.
And here's the state of the solver that you need. Right? So basically saying after you process all these literals, you're going to have a mapping where f of g of a maps to c because of the first equality.
Yeah.
Right? We are going to have g of a goes to g of b because of this equality, g of a equals g of b, right? And you have you reported this equality here, right? C different.
Yeah.
So this is the state of the procedure. The whole state doesn't matter for the matching, only this line here, the F, that you have this mapping. Basically, the whole point is that you can know if two things are equal by just following this F. If they map to the same thing, they are equal. For instance, C and F of G of A are equal Y. C maps to C, this is where the representativity is C, right? And F of G of A maps to C. And so both of them map to C. And so F of G of A is known to be equal to C. Right?
So you can no longer say that F of G of A is equal to itself.
No, you can, because you can ask F of G of A, you're trying to check if F of G of A is equal to F of G of A.
Yeah.
You apply F to both. You produce C in both cases.
Right.
My point is that if you keep applying F, you produce the same thing. If you start with the same thing, keep applying, you produce C. That's the advance that we maintain this procedure. In this way, what we have here is saying, we're going to, if X is being mapped to something, right, we're going to keep all the substitutions where the something is equal to the T you are trying to match. The second thing, the thing on the top, is where X is not being mapped to anything. If X is not being mapped to anything, I just extend my substitution. I add X maps to T, right? Everybody saw this first case. And now, here's the expensive case. We are trying to map to F, a pattern that starts off application F with a pattern T. Now I'm going to have to do this union for every instance of F that you have in your database of terms, right? You have to consider each one of them. With an example, it's going to be easier to understand. I have this example here. I'm going to try to go with step by step what is going on. We are trying to match this term T here, that is F of CD, with this pattern, right? How do we do it, right? F here is, I'm showing the picture. This is the state of my computation, right? I have this A goes is equal to C. I have that G of A is equal to C, right? This is the state, right? Let's see. The first thing we have to do, we are going to start applying the match. The first thing is that we have to, our pattern starts with F, right? Now we have two cases, we have two F applications in our F, right? You have F of CB and you have F of GAB, right? You have two different Fs in our F applications inside of data structure. In this way, we split in two cases, right? The first case, I'm going to try to match G of X with C, that's the first argument, right? You have the first argument of the pattern with the first argument of my F application, right? I'm trying to map G of X with C, and I'm trying to match the second argument, H of XA, with B, that's the second argument of my F of B, right? Let's keep doing, right? Now, I have two H applications, right? H of AD and H of CA, right? We break in two cases. Right? And the first case, we have this A and D, right? A and D are known to be equal. How do we do that? We have our F, right? We check. A maps to what? A maps to C, right? Everybody seen that? Oh, it's here. We have A maps to C, right? And D maps to D. Then A is not known to be equal to D, right? They map to different things, right? In this way, there's no way to match A with T, right? In this way, you produce the empty, the matching failed in this case. You get the empty set here. But let's do this case here. A and A match for sure, right? They're the same thing. In this way, we continue with the empty substitution, right? Now, X is not being mapped to anything, right? In this way, just extend my substitution with X going to C, right? And I do empty set union with this stuff is just X mapping to C, just one substitution where X is being mapped to C. Now, we have to map continue matching g of x with c. How many g applications we have? We have three, right? We have g of a, we have g of b, and g of c, and g of t, right? But why we're not taking the... Yes, I'm picking only the ones that are known to be equal to c, right? I'm trying to, let's go back quickly, I'm trying to match g of x with c. In this way, I have to consider all g applications that are known to be equal to c, right? It's clear this. And we have what? Three of them, right? G of a is equal to c, g of c, and g of d. We break in three cases, right? And now what happens is that the first two cases are okay, but this one doesn't match, right? Why these two cases are okay? Here you have, you're trying to match x with a, right? But this substitution here is compatible with x being equals to a. Why? Because a and c are known to be equal, right? And so you can keep it. The same thing, if you're trying to, x is being mapped to c, then you can continue with x equals c. But this one here fails because d and c are not known to be equal, right? Okay, no problem. Yeah, we started with the following question. You have a pattern.
Yeah. Okay. Where did capital F come from?
Oh, the capital F is the state of your solver. Right. The capital F is the set of equalities. It's a data structure that contains the equalities you know to hold. Right.
Where did they come from?
From your problem. I for instance, from something like that. Right. The equalities in your problem. Right.
Okay, so from that top line you construct the capital
F.
And then you go to your next slide, or the few slides on, and you're trying to say I want to match these two with respect to the F that I've generated from my first problem.
Yes.
Right, okay.
Okay, let's recap. I think it's a good point. The capital F comes from the equalities you have in your problem. Right? It's like Chadley when he was describing, oh, you have equalities in your problem. These are the... When you process these equalities, you're going to build capital F, right? And it contains all known equalities, right? Basically, how do you know if something is equal? You just keep applying F. For instance, A and C are known to be equal because if you do it, A goes to C and C goes to C. But look, G of A is also known to be equal to G of D, right? Why? Because G of A maps to C and G of D maps to C. Right? G of A goes to C.
Is that back on plus starts? With the G of A goes to C, is that in the equality?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Now forget that. I mean, because otherwise they imagine it. Just imagine that you have a data structure that contains all known equalities in your problem.
It's sort of like convergent and complement term rewriting where you apply all the steps possible so you can get all of the final terms.
Yes, you can view like that. There's one way to implement
this
blue lighting, right? For doing matching, you need a data structure that tells you, that's the important thing. If you want to do matching, you have to need a data structure that tells you what is known to be equal. Or at least, give me for each set of them that are known to be equal, you can return the representative, one of them as the representative of this equivalence class. Right.
Is there a difference between that and term rewriting at all?
You can do better. People can decide UF doing term rewriting, but the best algorithms are not based on that.
Well, okay. Conceptually, you could use term rewriting to generate this F.
Yes.
And once you have this F, you can then start doing your cleverness to match the
F. Yes. Yes. But in the real world, people want to do it. Yes, so they use union find the structure.
Yeah.
Yes. But for imaging, to understand imaging, assume that F exists, right? And now we can keep applying the imaging algorithm.
Sorry. How do you obtain
and T in the previous slide.
P also, I'm assuming here, T is also given. I mean, here just trying to explain you the dimension, right? Assume that there is some quantifier in your problem that is annotated with this pattern here, this trigger, right? And you are trying to match it against some term f of t of cd. Some part. Let's make the point very clear. The pattern comes from the notations, and the terms come from the quantifier free parts of your problem. Right? Remember, let's go back to this example. The terms are the quantifier free parts. They come from here. Right? You're going to try to match this pattern against these terms.
Just so they hang around. When you're at the next slide, you're still puzzled and just stare at the board.
And ignore what you need to say. Okay. Usually, if you see in SHD, you're going to have something annotation called pattern. Right? This is where the patterns come from annotations in your formula. If it's, the annotation is not provided, your solver is going to use some heuristic to come up with the annotations. Basically, what they do, they go inside of the formula and try to find terms that can be used as patterns. Right. Okay. And they're going to try to match these patterns against the terms you have, right, in the quantifier free parts of your formula. But keep in mind that this is not something fixed, because when you create a new instance, you keep adding more terms. This set keeps growing of these terms here. That's a ground. Right? You keep creating instances of your quantifier. For instance, in this example, I'm going to replace x by b. I'm going to add a new instance, fg of p equals b, right? And now you keep creating this new term.
So if I look at, I can see that if I take the g of b on the right hand side, I can see it's going to be a, so then I get, then I can do f of a, and f of a is not equal to c. But you then not equal to c, I don't know how both, and then not equal to c.
No, but keep in mind, this here is an instance of this quantifier. You're saying that for all x, f of g of x equals x. And so if this is for all x, it turns out for x equals b, this holds, f of g of b equals b, right?
But you understand how intuitive that's not the case?
Yes, you're going to get unsatisfied after that. You're going to get
unsatisfiable.
Right. I'm not trying to explain how SMG solver works. I'm just trying to explain the matching here, right? This is the part that's going to get. You agree that if you have only this part here, this is satisfiable, right? This is satisfiable, I can tell you. This is satisfiable. If you apply SMG solver like I described in the first lecture, this is satisfiable. You put this universal quantifier here. What the image is going to start doing is creating instances of this quantifier based on what you have here. And eventually, it can run forever, or eventually it's going to be able to show the problem to be unsaid, like in this case. After you add this new instance, you detect the satisfiability.
You do the substitution,
yes.
But then it all falls out, and it's
yes.
So as long as you have a big thing, this is unsatisfying,
yes.
Don't try and work it out in your head.
The point of the matching of this technique that is using the quantifier free case SMG solver as a support procedure, right? I'm just to show you the matching, just to show you how this is, where they're coming from, right? But I'm glad you're asking this question. Now I realize that I gave this lecture 1 week ago, maybe nobody understood anything.
There was something going on, we understand it.
But let's highlight why I have the M. I think this part here makes clear why do you need this uppercase F, right? We are trying to match G of X with C. Regular matching, they don't match at all, right? But if you consider all G terms that are equal to C, right, so you're going to see that you have many G terms that are equal to C. You have G of A that's equal to C, you have G of C that's equal to C, G of D that's equal to C. And so you have to, in the image, you're going to consider all these cases, right? That's why you need the uppercase F, you need the equalities, right? And you can keep doing it. I think if you can, I don't have time, I think I'm going to run out of time if I keep doing this example step by step, but just try to, what's the big picture? Right? What's important to keep from this part of the topic? Right? First thing, imaging is on top of SMT solver that doesn't support quantifiers, right? You have SMT, this is quantifier 3, you're running a SMT solver that only understands quantifier 3 problems. It's going to say set, right? Now you have this, you have a universal quantifier decorated with patterns that were provided by the user or your tool. SMT solver use some heuristics to come up with these patterns. Now I'm going to try to match these patterns against the terms you have, this database of terms, right? And when you do that, you're going to match using the equalities you have, that's the uppercase F, right? You're going to use this data structure that contains all equalities that are known to hold in your problem. And you're going to use that for doing the matching. You're going to create new instances, and you're going to call again the SMT solver for the ground, for the quantifier PK. And in this example, it stops right here, right? After you create, at this instance, the problems are satisfied. In this way, the matching is a heuristic that you can put on top of the SMT solver that doesn't understand quantifiers, and you can get you get something that can do in practice really well for these verification problems. Okay, but there are many things I didn't cover in matching. Just try to provide a general idea. There are many things, like the first thing is like how fast retrieval, right? In practice, you have many patterns and many terms, right? You have a lot of terms here, sometimes thousands and thousands, and thousands of patterns, right? And so you have a problem of fast retrieval. And the other problem is how to do that incrementally, right? Like Chesley make a point when you have theories, you want to do everything incrementally. The same thing for imaging, you want to do it incrementally, right? And the whole solution for this problem is to use indexing techniques. I'm not trying to explain how the indexing techniques work. I'm just going to give a hint. Basically, the idea is to compile a pattern that you want to match in a set of instructions that tell you how to do it efficiently. And now, the main point is that you have a bunch, in practice, you have a bunch of patterns in your problem, and they are similar to each other, right? And what we can do is combine these instructions in code trees. Instead of having sequences of instructions, you can have trees of instructions. And after you have that, you can match several patterns simultaneously, right? But let's now focus. I think this is just a bunch of optimizations. Let's try to focus on the limitations of imaging. The first limitation is that suppose that you don't have any quantifier three parts. You don't have this, right? And so you don't have anything to match against. If you don't have anything to match against, imaging cannot produce any instances, right? And you fail to prove completely trivial problems. Like this one, you have for all x, p of x, and for all x, not p of x. Everybody agrees this is unsatisfiable, right? There's no way to come up with a P that's always true and always false. And so imaging fails in something completely trivial, right? The other thing is your trigger can be too restrictive. For instance, here I provide a trigger F of G of X. There's no F here. There's no term that is, F doesn't show there, right? So there's no way to match this trigger. There's no way to find an instance. But if you have a more liberal trigger like g of x, I can find two instances. And with this trigger here, you can show the problem to be unsatisfiable. You're going to create two instances, right? F of g of a equals a and f of g of b equals b. And all this stuff here you can send for compiler 3 and send it over and it's going to return unsat. You don't believe me. I'll show you. Yeah, let's see why this becomes unsat, right? You have f of c here, right? So you can substitute g of a with c. And you can substitute g of b with c. You get f of c, f of c. A equals b. Right? You have a equals f of c, b equals f of c. A equals b, and so it's inconsistent.
Okay, that you said you don't have ground sheets.
Say again if you don't.
Well, in the previous limitation, you said that.
This one?
Yeah. Can I just say, you take something like the main closure, like you do in Proto? So if you don't find it, it's not there.
No, this is not. No, keep in mind that. You agree this is unsatisfiable, right?
Yeah, maybe they can have at least one X. You have no X.
No. I mean, we are always assuming that you have no empty universes, right? I mean, you never assume that you have a universe. Finite universes are not.
You said you didn't do anything. You just have that. The reason you said you
have
nothing
more than that. No. I mean, now, in SMC, we always need to assume that you, when you produce a model, the universe, I mean, for is always no empty. You don't care about empty universes. Another limitation, well, from the examples we've seen so far is that we saw that even if you don't have any, you don't have arithmetic, you don't have anything, it's not reputationally complete, right? Now, why not being reputationally complete may be bad, right? It's because you can get false positives, right? What happens is like people use the same sum in the following way. As I said in the beginning, you want to find bugs, right, in your program, right? A bug is a verification condition that is satisfiable, a formula that is satisfiable, right? If you're not verificationally complete, what may happen? Your solver may terminate saying, I didn't manage to show it to be unsatisfiable. But since you didn't manage to show that it's unsatisfiable, doesn't mean it's satisfiable. Well, you may say, well, I think it is set, right? I didn't manage to prove it, I think it is set, and you tell the user, I think there is a bug in this point in your program. What's going to happen is the user may spend time trying to understand if it is a bug or not, but it's actually not a bug, it's a limitation in your prover, right? That's what we call a false positive. But you can ask now, why do we use imaging, right? There are so many problems, right? Many things, right? The first thing, it integrates smoothly with SMT solver. If you have SMT solver that doesn't support quantifiers, it's very easy to put imaging on top of it, right? It's a proof-finding procedure, right? It's essentially trying to show that something is unsatisfiable, right? It has no support for showing that something is satisfiable. It's basically trying to add new instances of the universal quantifiers in such a way that in the end, you can show your problem to be unsatisfiable. It's something you call a proof-finding procedure, right? And finally, software verification benchmarks. Most of them, they may be big, but they are shallow, right? You're not trying to prove any deep mathematical theorem, right? These are sometimes proving something that is gigantic, but nobody's going to do it by hand because it's a lot of work, but it's something completely trivial, right? And so you're trying to prove big theorems, right? These big verification conditions, but they are big, but they are completely shallow, right? It's just a bunch of trivial manipulation to prove them. And humans are not going to be able to do it manually. Okay, this is imaging. I will try to focus now on decidable fragments, right? And explain a different technique for handling quantifiers. Okay, as I try to make the point, is like when you add linear arithmetic to the mix, the problem is undecidable. There's no sound and efficiently complete procedure for the problem. There's no way to do it. But actually, before I explain, I will try to emphasize how we represent models, right? We have been really vague when you have how to represent models here, right? You have these interpreted functions there, f, g. How do you represent f and g? If you say set, how do you represent interpretation for f and g, right? Well, one thing we can do is the following, right? We can view the model that the SMT solver produces, right? It's something that maps the symbols, the uninterpreted symbols in your formula, to uninterpreted symbols. Like for arithmetic, it's very straightforward what is happening. We are mapping like A to 1, B to 0, right? Everybody is going to assume, okay, this is interpretation, right? But you can extend the same idea for functions, right? You can say that f maps to something. You can view this as a lambda expression. It's like you can view as a function definition that takes one argument x. But this is like a little program, right? It's saying what? This it is a if then else. It's saying basically if x is 1, return 0, otherwise return 2. But the point I'm trying to make is that when you have quantifiers, right, or even for the quantifier, when you have encoded functions, you can view the model as a little functional program, right? For the constants, you're mapping them to values, right? And the functions to little pieces of code, right? And why this is nice? Because we're going to see that when you view models like that, you can model check. Here's just an example here in SMT notation. Basically, here I have a quantifier f of xx greater than or equal to x plus y, right? And you have other properties. You're saying that f of ab is less than a is greater than 0, and you're checking this satisfiable, right? If you check that, you generate this little program here, right? You're saying that b is 2, a is 1, and you have this little piece of code saying how f works, right? Basically saying that if f of 1, 2 returns 0, otherwise returns x plus 1, right? The first argument plus 1. You should view as a little program that you can even evaluate, right? You can execute, for instance, I can execute f of a plus 10, 20. I can execute this little program and get the result here, 12. Why I'm saying that, I think it's going to become clear later. But the first thing you can do if you view our models as little programs, you can check if this program really satisfies the quantifier, right? How can you do that? The first question is, does this f here satisfy this quantifier for all x, f of x greater than or equal to 0? Well, it does, right? But how can we do it? It does because if x is 1, it returns 0, that's greater than or equal to 0. Otherwise, it returns 2, that's also greater than or equal to 0. And so this little program satisfies this quantifier. But the nice thing is you can do that automatically by doing what? I replace my definition, f, by its definition, and I negate. Now I try to ask for an SMT solver that just understands quantifier-free problems. Is this unsatisfiable? It's going to say yes, this is unsatisfiable. There's no way that I can find an x that f of x is going to be less than 0, right? Since it is impossible to do that, this quantifier is satisfied. Everybody gets it, right?
Why do you ask what and then get a model answer? Why not ask, is that the thing that you're saying?
No, you're trying to prove, right? You're trying to prove that for all x,
yeah.
You're trying to show this is valid, right? It holds for all x's. How do you show that something is valid? You show that negation is unsatisfiable, right?
Yeah.
Right. And the other thing, when you take the negations, you can do solemnization as a quantifier-free problem. You can use an SMT solver here that doesn't have any support for quantifiers, right? Anyway, when you represent models like that, it's very simple to check if the model satisfies any universal quantifier, right? The point now is how do we find these models, right? we know that if we have them, we can check them. It's quite easy, right? Well, in general, we can't do it, but I'm going to try to show fragments where you can do it, right? The first fragments I want to focus is on a fragment where the interpreted symbols, where for the values, I mean, right now, after, from this slide to the end, when I use x and y, assume that there is a for all x, for all x1, for all x2. And for a, and I use a, b, and c for the constants, right? What Chesley in the beginning called, the first actually called variables. Right? When I say variable, it's for me here, for in this topic, a universal variable, a variable that's under a universal quantifier, right? In this fragment here, every variable is an argument of an interpreted function symbol, right? For instance, here, this formula is in the fragment because x1 is the arguments of f and g, and x2 is the arguments of h, right? No universal variable is the arguments of an interpreted function symbol. This one is not in the fragment, right? Because you have the plus, that's an interpreted symbol, right? In this fragment, you can have interpreted symbols like plus and less than, but the universal variables cannot be direct arguments of these interpreted symbols. Okay, when you have this restriction, right, I'm restricting how the universal formulas look like, the basic idea now is going to create, given an F that contains universal quantifiers and quantifier P, right, we are going to create a set F star, right, that's quantifier free and is equally satisfiable to F. Right, that's the idea. This is always possible to create this F star for this fragment that I described in the previous slide. The only thing that F star sometimes is infinite, right? But if F star is finite, it is a decision procedure. That's the nice thing. If you can build F star, apply the technique, and F star is finite, you have a decision procedure, right? If it is infinite, we'll discuss later if it's sufficiently complete or not, what we can do if F star is infinite. And the whole idea is to compute what we call domain, right? The domain, for every function symbol, we're going to build a domain. By domain, I mean, suppose that we start looking to the quantifier free part. For instance, here I want to say that A is in the domain of F, because A is the argument of F. B is in the domain of G, right? That's what I mean by the domain. And now here we are going to use a very simple rule, right? I'm going to show a simplified version of the procedure where you have only one variable per clause, right? But the idea can be extended for many variables, but just I'm going to do the simple case because the proof is easy to show why it works. I'm going to use this notation here. You have a clause that contains f of x, right? You know that every universal variable, remember that we said that every universal variable is the argument of some uninterpreted symbol, right? For instance, in this example here, we would have like, what's the argument you have g of x, right? Is the g here. And basically, I'm going to, if you have a c of f of x, right? And you have a term f of t, you instantiate this clause with t, right? It's not that different from in action, right? But you keep doing that until you saturate. Here's an example how we do it. Suppose I start with this ground part here, right? You have c is in the domain of g, c is in the domain of h, and a is in the domain of f. We start, we have this quantifier three parts, f star. The first step contains only these two, elements. Now, since a is in the domain of f, right, and I have a universal quantifier that contains f of x, I create an instance, right? I add this instance here. Now, the domain of g extended, we extend the domain of g, right? We have now f of a, b, this pair, right, is an argument of g, right, the domain of g, is a little bit bigger, right? But now we can instantiate the first quantifier, right? Like, because the domain of G contains this pair, right? We add a new instance, right? Now that we have the domain of H was extended with B, right? We keep doing that until we saturate, right? Now at this point here, we produce F star. There's nothing else we can instantiate, right? We did all possible instantiations, right? Now the claim is this F star is episatisfiable track. We can show that this F star is episatisfiable. We produce a model M, right, for this quantifier three parts, right, for F star. The first thing is that M is not necessarily a model for F, but we can build a new model from M. We can derive a model from M that's a model for F, right? That's the whole trick. And what's the basic idea, right? We have a model for F star, and we want to build a new model for F, right, based on this model M, right? The basic idea is to use something we call projection function with a picture. I think I have this picture here that makes it clear. Our SMT solver, we apply our SMT solver to F star, right? It produces a model for F, right? Interpretation for F, right? That maps some elements that are in the domain of AF to this. This is the elements in the domain of F, right? That are in the domain of F. And here's everything else. And you're mapping this set here to this one here. Basically, just to make it clear, the red part is this one here. Remember that I'm collecting these domains? The red part is this set here. It's the interpretation of this set. Right? The blue is everything else that's in the domain of the function F. The domain, as we know in mathematics, right? The projection function is going to do the following thing. It's going to map the blue part into the red, in something in the red part. Everything else, basically saying that the blue part doesn't matter. I'm going to map every element in the blue part to something in the red part and apply the interpretation for F for the red part. Basically, I'm going to replace this interpretation that we got for F star into this one here, right? I'm basically saying the blue part doesn't matter. Let's see how it works here. In our little example, the domain of H had B and C, right? And so if you apply our interpretation to these elements, B and C, you get 2 and 3. You get the elements 2 and 3. Our projection is essentially what? For 2 and 3 is the identity function. That's 2 to 2, 3 to 3. For everything else, I pick some elements. In this case, I'm picking 3. It doesn't matter who I pick, right? This is the projection. That's what I mean by mapping the blue area, everything else, to something in the red. Okay. You have these domains we computed,
yeah,
right? These are the
what's M, AM, and
yes. Basically you have these sets here, right? You have M.
Yeah.
You apply M to this set, right? For instance here. Suppose that you apply M to A.
Yeah.
You get what? 2, right?
Yeah.
Right. And the projection is built this way. And now suppose that I have H here, right? I'm going to do the trick here. It's the same, 2 to 0, 3 to 1, and a bunch of other stuff, right? And so my projection is simple. 2 goes to 2, 3 goes to 3, and everything else goes to 3. In this way, my function, my new interpretation for H is what? 2 goes to 0, 3 goes to 1, and everything else is going to behave like 3, right? You're mapping everything else to 3, and what's the result of H to 3 is 1. So it builds a new interpretation for age that is equal to this one. But in every other case, it behaves like tree. Right? That's. And after that, you can create this little function here. Right? You say that if x is 2, it returns 0. If it's 3 or anything else, it returns 1. Right? That's your little program. Right? And that's what we do. We get this guy here. And the claim is this guy, this n pi, and the pi is a projection, right? Is a model for f, right? And you can do model checking, right? Now that we have this notation, we can check. We can check if this stuff really satisfies this quantifier. For instance, this quantifier here. You can do what? Replace g and h by our interpretation, their interpretations. You have g here, you replace by this if then else. The same thing for the age, you get this formula, and you want to know, is this valid, right? It is valid if the negation is unsatisfiable, right? The existential quantifier, what can I do is colonization. Now I have quantifier free formula, and if you check it, if I send to solve for a quantifier free problem, this is, you want to get unsat. It's really this quantifier was satisfied by this model, right? It's the next slide. Why does it work? And the nice thing, I think another nice thing about why does it work, this is you want to find these proofs, variations of these proofs everywhere. Right. The proof, this proof works how? It's a general Buckles proof that was essential in this case. Especially if you view, like Chesley said, you have, if you describe as a transition, abstract transition system, your procedure. What's going to happen is that you're going to reach a final state that you didn't find the problem to be unsatisfiable. You're in a final state. Right? Remember, our final state is what? It was the F star, right? You reach a final state where F star was saturated. We built a model. From this model, we made some modifications, came up with N pi, right? And now you do the trick. Proof by contradiction. Assume that something was not satisfied. And now, when you assume that something is not satisfied, because of your saturation step, this is a final state of your abstract procedure, you derive a contradiction. This proof is everywhere. You're going to find resolution. You're going to find first order resolution, Boolean resolution, propositional logic resolution can be proved using this stuff. Superposition calculus, Fourier masking, a bunch of procedures are proved. The proof of correctness is the same. Right? And as I said, assume that n pi does not satisfy some clause, right? It's a proof by contradiction. Assume that this n pi doesn't satisfy a clause that you have in your problem. In this way, for some value v, I'm doing the case only for one variable, you can extend too many variables. In this way, there is some for some value v, this doesn't hold, right? Everybody agrees? Now, I know that is also not going to hold when I apply the projection, right? Remember, why? Remember that I instantiated f. Yeah, sorry. This doesn't hold. Why if I apply the projection still? If it doesn't hold for v, it also doesn't work for pi of f v. Why? Why? Because my interpretation of f doesn't change. Right. I remember, how do we build the interpretation of f? Right. You are saying that if the guy is here, apply the projection, the identity function doesn't change. Right. Mm-hmm. If it is here, it is being mapped to someone. There is someone here that has the same behavior. Right. In this way. If we know that it doesn't hold for v, it doesn't hold for pi of f of v. Right. But the pi is built based on the domain of a of f, right? In this way, I know there's some term t that shows up as an argument of f in my problem, right? There's some term that's an argument of f that is in my problem, in my saturated f star, right? Such that the interpretation of t is this pi here. In this way, but I instantiated the clause with t. point. In this way, if mpi is not a mod, doesn't satisfy this quantifier. My model m that was used to build mpi does not satisfy c of f t. Right? But c of f t is in f star. And we start with the assumption that m is a model for f star. And so we reach the contradiction. Right? That's how we do it. I mean, you're going to find this proof everywhere. It's good to have this detail in your mind, especially if you want to develop your own procedures.
I can tell you the proof, but I do not see why this proof justifies mapping the element to the other elements. So why this proof justifies the downward line in your previous
model?
Why does it justify if I take an element of the blue and not the red part? If I map this to an element
No, yeah, the first thing, the elements, the blue parts, you agree that I can change the blue parts arbitrarily, doesn't change, the f star, every f star, everything that is in f star is in the red part, right? You should view f star what is relevant about of your independent functions. If you have like a f of a, f of b, f of c, right, these are the elements that you care, right? Everything else, you can change the interpretation. F is not going to change. If you have a model for F star, you change this part, right? You're not going to affect the sensibility of F star. Right? This way, mpi is a model for F star also, right? That's one key property, right? The model mpi we built is also a model for F star, right? Then we claim that our model mpi is also a model for our original formula f with universal quantifiers. And this is approved by contradiction. Right? Why you can claim why the f star proof is, why the f star is, you may ask, I think maybe you are asking, why f star, I'm not introducing, keep in mind that when I'm building f star, I'm adding only instances of the universal quantifiers. This is sound, this is not. Adding instances of universal quantifiers is always sound. In this way, I'm not doing any unsound step, I'm just adding instances. In this way, there's no unsoundness. And now I'm proving that it's correct by this proof of contradiction. Right? I don't, this is the answer to your question?
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is what it's like when you have a day, you then call F the day off. So you can just say that F the day goes to somebody's value. So, like you said, in our program,
yeah, this is a nice way to do it. I mean, but keep in mind, I mean, you have to be when you do the final, the real proof, you cannot use this kind of argument. But that's the idea. This is an intuition. You doesn't matter what it is, the blue part, right? So you never call it. Yeah, so you can view it this way. But as I said, f star can be super big, right? Can be even infinite, right? And so in practice, we don't build f star. We do it lazily, right? We do it incrementally, right? You start with only the quantifier free part, check if it is set. If it is set, you build a model m. You can extend to mpi, model check, right? If the model checking step fails, you add more instances. You can keep doing that. You can build f star incrementally, right? And I think the main refinement is another idea that happens everywhere. I think in SMT, you find model bases everywhere. There's model base combination, model base this, model base that. And even in set solving, I think this idea is there. Right? The idea that the proof is a byproduct. You're trying to find a model. When something goes wrong during the model construction, you react. And you build a proof as a byproduct, right? In CTCL, you're trying to build your interpretation incrementally. When something goes wrong during the construction, you find a local inconsistency, you use resolution, right? And you're essentially building a proof as a side effect of trying to recover from inconsistency. You have this duality that building a model, you build a proof as a byproduct of trying to find a model, right? This way, model-based techniques are used everywhere. And for building F-star is a way, right? Instead of building F-star in one shot, I start with the empty set and try build a model from there, right? The model is not going to satisfy my universal quantifiers. I'm going to find some counterexample, right? And I keep building that F-star incrementally, starting from this empty set of instances. And I keep doing the model check to find these instances, right? I have an example here. Suppose that you have f of a equals 1 and f of b equals minus 1, right? I'm going to start with only the quantifier of p parts. I build a model, build my npi, right? My npi is saying that x is 2, basically saying that if x is a is leading up to 2, right? It's saying it satisfies this one, right? You have a is 2. F of 2 is 1, so 1 equals 1, satisfied. Otherwise, it's minus 1, right? You have F of B is 3, F of 3 is minus 1 equals minus 1, satisfied also, right? This way, this is pi, this is a model for this F0, right? Let's see if it's a model for the quantifier, right? We do the model checking step, right? We find a counterexample. We find a counterexample, S1 equals 2 is a counterexample. And now is the trick. You do the inverse of the projection. You may ask, what is the term in my F that maps to 2? It's A, right? Now you're going to ask if this one is 1,
no,
right?
I want to ask where the 3 comes from.
This is a empty sober. You ask the empty sober. Is this satisfied?
Yes.
And now here, in model check, you get a counterexample, S1 equals 2, right? Now, how do I instantiate? I instantiate, I ask, what's the term that evaluates to A? To 2 is A, right? If you ask, if this one is 1, you pick 1. But the only thing you have to guarantee for this stuff to be complete, if F substances is finite, or even infinite, for the first order, pure first order logic case, you have to be fair. If eventually you have to pick, suppose that there was A and B a choice, you pick A now, and next time, you cannot keep delaying the choice of B indefinitely, right? You have to be fair. That's another thing that's fairness, you have to, especially when you have quantifiers, one big thing is to be fair, right? And now you add this, you extend with this instance, F of A less than 0, now you are done. Right, f of a is 1, f of a is less than 0 in consistency, you terminate with unsatisfiable, right? Now, the question, right? Is f star, is this process, if f star is finite, fine, this is a decision procedure. If it is infinite, this is actually complete, right? Would be great because it's not just Q for some logic, right? You can have theories there in the mix. There is one big result of first order logic, right, is that if you have an infinite set of sentences, a bunch of formulas, right, if this set is unsatisfiable, right, then it contains a finite set that's also unsatisfiable, right? This is a big property of first order logic, right? Now, in the literature, you're going to find many places they're saying that a theory is a set of sentences, right? And now you can say, wow, you have a set of sentences T here, right? That's maybe infinite. I have my F star that's infinite. I have this set here, now it's infinite, right? This is pure first order logic now. I put everything, all my knowledge about T is in this set of sentences, right? And so this is pure first order logic. And so there is a finite subset that's also unset, right? And now I can say, oh, if I do a fair enumeration, I have an especially complete procedure, right? That would be super cool, but you're going to see that this is counterintuitive, right? The main point here is that you have this, for instance, suppose here arithmetic, you have T of Z contains everything we know that's true about arithmetic. That's what you call, this is our T of arithmetic. And you have F star. This is an infinite set of first order logic sentences, right? Applying compactness, we have a finite S. And so you can do a Fermi narration and find this S. But consider now this example. I have this F here. Basically, it's just a convoluted way just to get in the fragment, right? So we are in the fragment that, in theory, this F and this F star, they are equi-satisfiable. This holds independently of this compactness, whatever. You can prove that independently of first order logic compactness. This guy here is saying that F has an infinite chain. Basically, there is a chain. If you keep applying F, you can keep getting bigger and bigger values. Suppose that you do F of 0. F of F of 0 is bigger than F of 0. You apply F of 0 is bigger. You can keep, if you keep applying F, you get this ascending chain, right? And the second quantifier is saying that there is an upper bound on F. For integer arithmetic, this is unset, right? You're saying that it's an infinite chain, and you're saying that there is an upper bound, this is unset, right? But F star you have is this guy here, right? Trust me. Every finite subset is satisfiable. Every subset you pick here is stable. Because you're not going to be, every finite subset, this infinite chain is going to be finite, right? You're going to get a fragment of this infinite chain. You just pick A to be bigger than this element and you satisfy, right? And so what is wrong, right? What is wrong? The problem is this idea that a theory Z has a set of sentences. This is a imprecise factorization, right? First, for theory of linear integer arithmetic, T of Z is the set of all first order sentences that are true in this structure, what we know about arithmetic, our intended, I mean, in our mental model, right, our intended data structure for the integers, it contains only 0, 1, minus 1, minus 2, 2, and so on, right? But the problem is that this set of first-order logic sentences has no standard models, right? It has models that contains like infinity, right? Infinity is there, right? F and F star, they are equi-satisfiable, right? And both of them are satisfied in this non-standard model, right? F star is satisfied. It's not in the model we care, but it is F star and F are satisfied in this non-standard model, right? The right way to view...
You don't really mean that we wrote for the first two lines, right? Because it's not the set of all first-order sentences that are true. It's just the standard structure. It's just the standard...
No. In several, what my point is that if you find in literature, a lot of people characterize a theory as the set of sentences. And they say, oh, for arithmetic, we can think the set of all first order sentences that are true in our intended structure. Right? You find this kind of definition in the literature. And this for quantifier free case, this is very satisfactory. Right? You cannot see any difference. You cannot see these problems I'm describing here. A modern definition of a theory that's much more precise is that you don't say a theory is a set of sentences, but it's a class of structures, right? Now I'm saying the theory of arithmetic is this structure, the structure we know as the integers, right? Where the only integers that exist are the 0, 1, minus 1, minus 2, 2, and so on, right? There are no infinities, removing the non-standard models, you see, these are the models I care about, right? This alternative definition of what a theory is, compactness doesn't hold, right? You lose compactness, F and F star A still would be satisfiable, right? But the point I'm trying to make, a lot of people, if you go into the literature, I can show you a bunch of papers that say a theory is a set of sentences, right? This is imprecise, that's the only thing I'm saying, and I'm showing here an example, right? This idea, I said that, okay, for in this fragment, the universal variables cannot occur as arguments of uninterpreted symbols, can only show as arguments of uninterpreted symbols, but you can extend, right? You can do some limited use of interpreted symbols, like you can have universal variables as arguments of bounds. Things like x1 is greater than or equal to 0, or less than or equal to n, some limited form. He can show up in this kind of term, can show up like as offsets, like x1 plus 2, right? That means extensions, right? If you go, you have an online tutorial that describes many of these fragments, right? You can play with these examples online. It's riseforfun.com, it's a free tutorial. There's a section on quantifiers, you can find a bunch of examples of decidable fragments that can be decided using this kind of technique. What?
Five.
Five, okay. Great. Related to work, I mean, what I described here, you can view as generalizing technique. Many ideas you can find in the literature, like Bernard Finkel class, certified many sorted logic, local to, this is generalizing a bunch of approaches you can find in the literature. I will not talk about this. This was planned. The last time I gave this talk, I didn't manage to go into this part. But you can check online. I want just to conclude. Okay. We saw e-matching. E-matching is only for proof finding. It never shows anything to be set. Right? It's useful for showing that something is unset. It's fast. Right? Well, it's relative. Everything's relative. Right? It's fast compressed with everything else when handling quantifiers. It's effective in shallow proofs, it handles big formulas. It's not sufficiently complete even for pure first-order logic. And the main advantage of imaging that can regularly solve VCs that sometimes have even 5 megabytes. We saw this complete instantiation, can decide many useful fragments. It has this idea of, it can produce models, right? It's slower than imaging. You can view as a way to complement imaging, right? I didn't have time to talk about saturation, but it was another proof finding technique, right? Very effective for proof finding, but it's sufficient compute for pure first order logic. It's also slower than imaging. I didn't cover, there's a lot of stuff about quantifiers that I didn't cover, like quantifier elimination is a big thing. Several fragments support quantifier elimination. You can eliminate the quantifiers, right? If you have just arithmetic, you don't have any type of symbols, right? Linear real arithmetic, you can do Fourier-Motzkin. For linear hindrance arithmetic, you can do Cooper, right? If you search for these keywords, you can find the algorithms online. For non-linear real arithmetic, you can find CAD. Algebraic data types, you can go to Hodges' book, right? I didn't cover finite model finding, and there are many other decidable fragments that I didn't cover, right? But I just give you here some keywords for searching, right? But the main challenge, I think, if you want to work in this area, I think a big thing is, as I said, what people really care are satisfiable instances. Right. And it's in the literature, lots of techniques that are efficiently complete, but usually they don't terminate in satisfiable instances. Right? Nobody cares to characterize in which fragment this procedure terminates for satisfiable instances. Right? Or if it is not efficiently complete, but for this fragment here, it's a decision procedure. Right? In general, it's not an efficiently complete procedure, but for this fragment, it is a decision procedure. These are very... I think a very worthwhile goal is to design new procedures that are effective for specific problem domains, for specific fragments, right? The idea would be like you design a recipe for coming up with something cool. Find a particularly useful domain, a domain that's used for some application is very interesting for you, right? Try to find the decision procedure for this fragment. Right? Now you have a result. You can characterize a fragment that is decidable, right? This is a result. It's a fragment that's useful in practice, and you can come up with a procedure that's efficient. You can prove a complexity result about this fragment. And in the end, you have something that's a theoretical value. You're characterizing a new fragment that's decidable. And at the same time, you have a procedure that's effective, that solves problems that happen in the real world. I just want to finish with this idea. I think you don't find these a lot in the literature. And the techniques we have right now to find satisfiable instances only in the beginning, right? I don't think there's any SMT solver that's really effective in showing that doubles with quantifiers that are satisfiable to be able to produce this answer, right? Saying it is indeed satisfiable, right? And another application, you have to keep in mind that if you can do that, it's not just replication, you can do synthesis, right? Synthesis is a big thing. I don't know if you're following. A lot of people are working synthesis and has many applications in software verification, software development, and so on. But if you care about synthesis, putting synthesis, not trying to work at synthesis is like, oh, let's try to have something that solves this problem. No, no. Try to work on synthesis like saying, I'm going to use logic. Right? I'm going to try to characterize this problem as logic. I'm going to characterize the problems that it can handle as a decidable fragment, right? And now you can have a result, you can talk about the complexity of the procedure to resolve, you can have something, instead of being a bag of tricks, something that has some theoretical foundation. Thank you.
What's up?